That day on the march back to rejoin the column, Zuger and Jan Schroot suffered the worst infestation of fly they had yet met with in the valley of the Zambezi. They rose from the ground to sit thickly upon their legs and clustered on the backs of their necks and between their shoulder blades, so that he and Jan Schroot took turns to walk behind each other and brush them off with freshly cut buffalo tail. As suddenly as they had entered it, they found themselves out of the fly belt, and with blessed relief from the torment, they settled down to rest in the shade. Within half an hour they heard distant singing, and as they waited for the caravan to come up, they smoked and chatted in the desultory fashion of the good companions they had become. During one of these long pauses in their talk, Zuger thought he saw vague movement on the far side of the shallow valley in front of them, probably a herd of kudu or a troop of baboon, both of which were plentiful in the valley, but apart from the buffalo herd, the only game they had encountered since leaving Tet. The approaching caravan would have alarmed whatever it was, Zuger thought, removing his cap and using it to drive away the persistent cloud of tiny black mopani bees which hovered around his head, attracted by the moisture of his eyes and lips and nostrils. The movement in the forest opposite was not repeated. Whatever it was had probably crossed the ridge. Zuger turned back to listen to Jan Schroot. "The rains only stopped 6 weeks ago," Jan Schroot was musing aloud. "The waterholes and rivers up on the high ground will still be full. Not ya, of course. This ground drains too steeply." He indicated the dry and rocky watercourse below them. "So the herds spread out and follow their old roads." He was explaining the complete lack of elephant, or even recent evidence of elephant herds in the valley, and Zuger listened with attention, for here was an expert speaking. "The old elephant roads, they used to run from the flat mountain of Good Hope to the swamps of the far Sud," he pointed north. "But each year they shrink as we, the yachters, hunters, and men like us, follow the herds and drive them deeper and deeper into the interior." Jan Schroot was silent again, and his pipe gurgled noisily as he sucked on it. "My father told me that he killed the last elephant south of the Olifants River, the River of Elephants, when he was still a young man. He boasted that he killed 12 elephants that day, he alone with his old roer, muzzle loader, that was too heavy to hold to the shoulder. He had to rest it on the crutch of a forked stick he carried for it. 12 elephants in one day by one man. That is a feat." He gurgled his pipe again, and then spat a little yellow tobacco juice. "But then my father was even more famous as a liar than he was as a hunter." Jan Schroot chuckled and shook his head fondly. Zuger smiled, and then the smile vanished, and his head jerked up. He narrowed his eyes, for a tiny dart of reflected sunlight had struck his eye coming from the same place across the valley. Whatever he had seen was still there, and it was neither kudu nor baboon. It had to be a man, for only metal or glass could have shot that reflection. Jan Schroot had noticed nothing, and he was musing on. "When I rode with Cornwallis Harris, we found the first elephant on the Kashan Mountains. That's 1,000 miles further north of where my father killed his herd. There was nothing in between. It had all been hunted bare. Now there are no elephant in the Kashan Mountains. My brother Stefan was there 2 years ago. He tells me that there are no elephants south of the Limpopo River. The Boers graze their herds where we hunted ivory. Perhaps we will find no elephant even up there on the high ground. Perhaps there are no elephant left in all the world." Zuger was not really listening anymore. He was thinking about the man on the opposite side of the valley. It was probably somebody from the caravan, a party sent ahead to cut firewood for the night's bivouac. Yet it was still early to think of making camp. The singing of the bearers was louder now. There was a single voice carrying the marching song. Zuger recognized it. The man was a tall Angoni, with a fine tenor voice, and a poet who improvised his own verses, adding to them and altering them on the march. Zuger, cocking his head, could make out the words. "Have you heard the fish-eagle cry above Marawi? Have you seen the setting sun turn the snows of Kilimanjaro to blood? and then the chorus coming in after him. Those haunting African voices, so beautiful, so moving. Who will lead us to these wonders, my brother? We will leave the women to weep. We will let their sleeping mats grow cold. If a strong man leads, we will follow him, my brother. Zuga smiled at the next verse, as he recognized his name. Bakela will lead us like a father leads his children. Bakela will give you a keti of samsam beads. Bakela will feed you upon the fat of the hippopotamus and meat of the buffalo. Zuga closed his mind against the distraction, concentrating on the man across the valley. Here, 100 miles from the nearest habitation of men? It must have been somebody from the caravan. Woodcutter? Honey hunter? Deserter? Who knew? Zuga stood up and stretched, and Yanshurut knocked out his pipe and stood with him. The head of the column appeared amongst the trees lower down the slope. The red, white, and blue banner flapped lazily open and then drooped again dejectedly. Zuga glanced once more at the opposite slope. It seemed deserted again. He was tired. The soles of his feet felt as though he had marched across burning embers, for they had been going hard since dawn, and the barely healed knife wound in his hip ached dully. He should really go up that slope to check what he had seen, but it was steep and rocky. It would take another 30 minutes of scrambling to reach the crest and return. They went down to meet the caravan, and when Zuga saw Robin striding along with that easy, coltish grace of hers behind the standard-bearer, he lifted his cap and waved it above his head. She ran to him, laughing like a child with delight. He had been gone 3 days. Below a polished face of smooth black rock, that when the river was in spate would be a roaring cascade, there was a bend in the dry waterbed filled with pure white sand. On the banks above it, the wild mahogany stood tall and vigorous, its roots in water, and the baboon had been scratching in the sand below the bank. Robin and Zuga sat together on the edge of the dry waterfall, watching the men that Zuga had set to digging for water. "I pray there will be enough," Robin watched them with interest. "I have not used my bath since we left Tet." Her enamelled hip bath was the expedition's single bulkiest item of equipment. "I'll be satisfied with enough for a pot of tea," Zuga replied vaguely, but he was clearly distracted. "Something is worrying you?" she asked. "I was thinking of a valley in Kashmir." "Oh, was it like this?" "Not really, it's just that..." He shrugged. In that faraway valley, when he had been a young ensign leading a patrol ahead of the battalion, he had seen something as he had today. Something of no account. A stray movement, a glint of light, that might have been off a gun barrel, or the horn of a wild goat. Then, as now, it had been too much trouble to check it. That night he had lost 3 men, killed, while they fought their way out of the valley. The fight had earned praise from his colonel, but the men remained dead. He glanced up at the slanting sun. There was an hour of light left. He knew he should have climbed that slope. While Robin watched him with a puzzled expression, he wavered a few seconds longer, and then with an exclamation of exasperation stood up wearily. His feet still ached abominably, and he rubbed his hip where the knife wound throbbed. It was going to be a long walk back down the valley. Zuga used a deep and narrow ravine to get out of the camp unobtrusively. And once clear, he scrambled out and kept to the thicker bush just above the riverbed until he reached a tangled barrier of driftwood carried down during the recent rains which blocked the dry water course from bank to bank. He used this to cover his crossing and started up the far slope. He went very carefully, dodging from one tree to another and watching and listening before each move. On the crest there was a faint movement of cooler air, the evening breeze coming down the escarpment that cooled the sweat on his neck and almost made the hard climb worthwhile. It seemed that was all the reward he would get. The stony ground was too hard to carry sign, and it was deserted of life, animal or human. However, Zuga was determined to make up for his previous sloth. He stayed too long. It would be fully dark before he reached the camp again. Moonrise was late, and he risked a broken leg moving over this sort of terrain in the pitch dark. He turned to go back, and he smelt it before he saw it, and the hair prickled along his forearms, and he felt his belly muscles contract. Yet it was such a commonplace smell. He stooped and picked up the small, squashed brown object. He had smoked the last of his own cheroots 2 days before. Perhaps that was why his nose was so sensitive to the smell of tobacco. The cigar had been smoked down to a thin rind and crushed out so it resembled a scrap of dried bark. Without the smell to guide him, he would never have found it. Zuger shredded it between his fingers, and there was still a little residual dampness of saliva in the chewed end. He lifted his fingers and sniffed them. He knew where he had smelled that particular scented type of Portuguese tobacco before. Camacho left 15 of his men well back off the crest, in a tumble of rock that looked like a ruined castle, and whose caves and overhangs gave shade and concealment. They would sleep, he knew, and he grudged it to them. His own eyelids were drooping as he lay belly down in cover, on the other side of the ridge watching the caravan making camp. He had only two of his men with him to help him mark the sentries and skerms, the watchfires and the tent sites. They would be able to lead the others in, even in the complete darkness before the moon. If that should become necessary. Camacho hoped not. In the dark, mistakes could be made, and it needed only a shot or a single shout. No, they would wait for the moon, he decided. The Englishman had come into camp earlier, just before the caravan halted. He had the Hottentot with him, and they both hobbled stiffly like men who had made long, hard marches. Good, he would sleep soundly, was probably doing so already, for Camacho had not seen him in the last hour. He must be in the tent beside the woman's. He had seen a servant carrying a steaming bucket of water to her. They had watched the Hottentot sergeant set only 2 sentries. The Englishman must be feeling very secure. 2 sentries, merely to watch against lions. They would probably both be fast asleep by midnight. They would never wake again. He, personally, would cut one of them. He smiled in anticipation, and he would send a good knife to cut the other. The remaining Hottentots had built their usual lean-to shelter and thatched it in a rudimentary fashion. There was no chance of rain, not at this season, and not with that unblemished eggshell blue sky. It was almost 200 paces from the tents. A groan or a whimper would not carry that far. Good, Camacho nodded again. It was working out better than he had hoped. As always, the 2 tents were set close together, almost touching. The gallant Englishman guarding the woman, Camacho smiled again, and felt his drowsiness lifting miraculously as his groin charged once more. He wished the night away, for he had already waited so long.